Hello, it is your latest episode of Inside the Pod. I'm Ben Pike and you're joining us live from Cereals today in Lincolnshire. It is very hot. It is very hot and it is very windy, so you might hear a bit of extra wind noise than what you normally do with this podcast, but we will persist nonetheless. We've been walking around the site to see what's going on and now have landed back at the PGRO stand where there's been a short presentation about the Nitrogen Climate Smart project. A little bit more about that in a moment, but there's lots of other things going on the stand today. So what we're going to do is run through some of the highlights of the stand with various members of the PGRO's team and hopefully grab one or two farmers, have a chat with them about what they're doing here, and we'll get some insight into that. So a little bit of a different format today. Hope you enjoy it. So we've just had a short briefing on the progress of the Nitrogen Climate Smart project, which hopefully you will have heard and read by now, is a major project that is funded by DEFRA through the Innovate UK Fund. And it's designed to displace imported soya primarily and also reduce UK agriculture's contribution to carbon emissions. And it's been continuing apace for 2 years now. We've just had some updates from ADAS on the work that they're doing, and also from MacArthur BDC. John MacArthur has been telling us about some of the work that they've been doing on post-harvest processing of pulses and getting along with the SRUC getting pulses into livestock rations. Some of the challenges around that, making some progress on the areas that really are going to unlock the potential of this project. So there's a huge amount of excitement about the project. There is still time to continue working on it. Rather than running through everything that's been going on, there is an excellent write-up in the latest Pulse magazine, the Pulse Summer Edition, which is available on the PGRO website. And if you're a CPM subscriber, it is or will be inserted into the magazine, which will be landing on your doorsteps any day now. That is probably the best place to read up on everything that's going on with that project in more detail. But one of the key messages from the briefing was that BOFIN, the British On-Farm Innovation Network, we'll be doubling the amount of farmers that are involved in trials for the next year. So those that will be growing crops this autumn and the spring, they want to find 20 more farmers. So they've already got 20 pulse pioneers, as they're called, that are contributing to the project by conducting trials and feeding in their data into the community. But they're also now recruiting for 20 more. So it's quite a big step up, quite a big leap forward, and very exciting for the farmers involved, who not only are going to gain insight and information about the work that they're doing on the farm, but also are being paid to carry out that work, such as the model that's employed as part of this project. We are now joined by Bryony Graham, who is one of the Pulse Pioneers, who's just signed up to the programme. Bryony, thanks for joining us. What's your reason for becoming part of the Pulse Pioneer element of the NCS project?
I think the concept of looking at the bigger picture of a crop in terms of the industry as a whole and the impact that increasing pulse production in the UK could have on the carbon footprint of the entire industry is really important. And so for our generation of farmers moving forward, we really need to be taking responsibility for that as best we can. And I come from this from a scientific background and moved back to the family business in 2017. So just think the idea of a data-driven approach to that really appealed to me.
Yeah, so that sounds sensible. So tell us a bit about your farm then, so people can get an idea of what you do.
Yep, so we're 300 hectares of combinable crops on the Essex Herts border on really heavy clay. So it can be a bit of a challenge establishing crops in the autumn, and beans have been incredibly variable as a result of that. So we've had some really difficult years with beans. We've given up for a couple of years. Last year, weather came dry in November, and we've got what looks like, touch wood, quite a decent crop. So, but we're looking at, I'm interested in the data, particularly for what the NCS project is, one of its goals is to look at how much nitrogen is left in the soil and putting numbers on that for the following cereal crop. And I think from our perspective, looking at beans as a break crop, but also in the context of the broader rotation, is really important, and the data that brings.
So what other break crops might you grow if you weren't growing beans? Have you got others that you prefer?
We do a lot of oats. So we stopped growing rape several years ago. We have a no insecticide policy on the farm and have done for over a decade, so rape just doesn't really make sense for us now. But so a combination of beans and oats primarily, and now a lot of SFI options we use as breaks, so we will see where they go.
So tell us about your bean crop and the trial that you're going to do at the moment. What sort of size have you set out, and you know, ultimately you've alluded to a little bit, but what are you trying to find out? What would you hope to find out from the trial that you're doing this year?
Yep, so we came into the project a little bit later, so our crops had already been drilled. So we have a bean crop and an adjacent wheat crop in the field next door. So we will look at the so we've done a load of soil testing now before the crops were really well established, and then we will test the soil again when we go into a second wheat in the wheat field and a wheat after beans in the pulses field, and see whether there is any difference in nitrogen in the soil before the crops established, and then obviously if there is any impact on yield following that. Within the bean crop, we've also done tramline trials with Blue N, which is a biological Corteva product that fixes atmospheric nitrogen. So the question there is whether on the treated Blue N treated pulses, whether there is any additional nitrogen in the soil in those treated areas as a result of the plant being able to fix atmospheric nitrogen as well as fixing in the soil. So Corteva are interested in the data on that side too. So we shall see.
So there could be, if I'm understanding it correctly, a sort of double benefit of having that residual nitrogen plus what Blue N can capture from the atmosphere. That must be quite exciting, not only given the cost of nitrogen, but the fact that you're sort of sustainably setting that in the soil. So I guess that's quite an exciting progress for you to have if indeed that does sort of end up being the case.
Absolutely. Hypothetically, financially, all of those things. I think moving forward, that's potentially something that could be really interesting and quite a powerful tool.
What's your gut instinct then? What do you think beans do for your rotation? From what you've seen over the years, what do you think beans do for your rotation at the moment?
To be honest, for us at this time, it is more a weed control option, in that being on heavy soil, black grass is a major problem, and having pulses in the rotation gives us chemical control options that we wouldn't have. We would often, I know I shouldn't, but plough before beans, terrifyingly. But it's very effective and it does the job. Used in the right way. So yeah, for us it's a weed control step as much as anything else, but I think that's because we've never really looked in a scientific way at whether there is a benefit to the following cereal crop in terms of nitrogen. So that's one of the major reasons we thought this project was really interesting.
And have you been involved so far in the kind of community element of Boffin and the NCS project, and sort of seen a little bit about what that involves from, because I guess that's another part of the process, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. I think because there's so much on wheat and there's so many options available, so much information out there, so many products, and then you become part of this community and there's some real experts and people that are absolutely at the top of their game and have so much experience and so much knowledge about this crop that's kind of largely forgotten about, and like you chuck it in as a break crop and then see what you don't really care what you get back from it. So yes, it's a real access to a pool of expertise that I think I'm very much on the absorbing side rather than contributing to at the moment, but maybe that will change.
it will come around in time, I'm sure. The whole point of an event that we've just had on the stand today is to try and encourage other growers to consider becoming a pulse pioneer, to sort of show them the benefits of that. From your point of view, as someone who is at the other end of it, being asked for the data and asked to set out the trial, practically how much work is involved in that? Because I think some people might be put off. Sometimes trials work can be quite onerous, but I don't know if that's the case for you, but perhaps you could give people who are thinking about it a flavour of what's involved.
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's very well structured and very clear, and it's clearly, and there's some big partners involved in this project, so the resources that you have and the guidance on what you need to do and when is very, very clear. Yes, leaf sampling a couple of times does take a few hours, soil sampling does take a few hours, but from an agronomy perspective, you should be walking the fields anyway. It just makes you do it. So And the way I see it is you're being paid for that time and you get an awful lot of data back for a couple of hours in the field. So yes, there is obviously a time component to it, but it's probably something you should be doing anyway. So you're kind of getting paid for something that you then get additional benefit from. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, and you don't expect to get something for nothing, do you?
Exactly.
And like some of the work that you're doing anyway. So.
Exactly.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time today, Bryony. We look forward to hearing some of the results. I guess after harvest, we'll have a look at the data and might come back to you then and see how you're getting on. But thanks very much for joining us.
No problem at all. Thank you.
I'm joined now by Erin Matlock, who's the research agronomist with PGRO. Erin, what have people been asking you about as they've been approaching the stand over the last sort of day and a bit? Has there been some sort of topics that have really shone through in sort of consistency in what people are asking you?
A lot of consistency comes from growers going back into peas and beans in the rotations now with some changes to the SFI payments. And also just asking why the plants are a little bit shorter this year compared to last season. And it really has come down to weather on that. So there's no real surprises, no strong concerns, and very, very positive conversations.
So the change in payments, you know, there's a sort of gut feeling out there that would drive people to perhaps revisit their rotations and maybe relook at what they might want to do on their farm rather than just going into stewardship. That's been quite a common question that's come up, isn't it? What sort of questions is that driving then? Once they say that's what they're going to, what they're considering, what's the question then from an agronomy point of view that they want to know from you?
Well, first off, they want to know what is the newest variety, the best variety. So we have the descriptive list to go by that. Then it's just, is there anything new for herbicides or fungicides that weren't around before? Fortunately, there isn't a whole lot more. So there isn't a whole lot new compared to 5 years ago. So just getting back to basics, make sure your field selection is properly drilled at the right time and have that consolidated seed bed to mitigate some foot rot risk.
And we've just been talking about some of the key principles for people who have perhaps been away from the crop for a while. And you've given me your sort of top three tips for sort of establishing your peas or your beans effectively. Do you want to run us through those in a bit of detail in terms of what you would advise growers who have perhaps been away from them for a while and are now coming back to them this autumn?
So the first one I was discussing is a clean field. So with that is there isn't a whole lot of herbicide options for peas or beans. So your best mode of defense there is to go into a clean field and really consider post-harvest weed management for this season, plus your stale seed bed to really get off to a good start for your weed control. If you are unsure what to use, what is approved, consider herbicide labels that are out there. We also have a snippet on our website as what can be used according to label and EMUs. And you know, your main things you're looking at again is your black grass. Wildleaf control is fairly easy to do, but it's looking at your black grass and your other grass weeds.
Okay. So not a huge amount has changed perhaps for someone who has been out of the crop for 5 years or so. Looking at the plots here today, there's a bit of variety in how they've all looked. Some looking really good, some obviously having some of the drought stress that you've alluded to. But you know, just generally from your walking of the crop, what's your assessment of where we are today in the sort of middle of June? How's the crop looking?
For the drought stress we've had, the crops are looking great. There's lots of even current growers saying my beans are short compared to last year. That comes down to the heat stress and the dryness that we have had. But they're potting up well. So even though the plants are shorter, pod set might be a little bit shorter, but there's lots of pods. So it looks to be fairly promising despite the year we've had.
So height's not necessarily a determining factor this year, because I know last year we did interviews with people who were looking at 6 foot tall bean crops, which is something I've not seen too often, but we're not seeing that certainly in the crop plots here. I guess we're looking at the best ones are maybe 3 foot, 3.5 foot tall, but that's not necessarily a decision on whether that's going to be a really good yielding crop or not.
Yeah, that's correct. So we have shorter internodes this year, so there's just as many flowers or pods on the plants. They're just shorter internodes. So it just doesn't look as pretty, but we should be getting the same yields.
And generally sort of disease and pest pressure, what are you picking up?
Surprisingly, there hasn't been a whole lot of chocolate spot, but there is quite a bit of bean rust here. And we actually have a demo of that on our site with and without fungicides. So fungicides is something that if you can consider in with your beans just to get in front of the rust.
There's quite a stark difference between the plots that have been well treated with a good program and the one that hasn't here at Cereals. it really looks quite sort of decimated, doesn't it, without that fungicide to protect it.
Yeah, and we're not talking super expensive state-of-the-art fungicides. It's a very basic program. Rust is easy to control. You just got to get on with it.
Great stuff. Thanks for your time, Erin. And if you want to get in touch with Erin, her details are on the PGRO website. As with the rest of the team, you can reach out for advice whenever you need it. Thanks, Erin.
Thank you.
So I'm with Roger Vickers now, CEO of PGRO. Roger, it's hard to explain everything that you can see on the stand here, but you were responsible for sort of setting out exactly what you wanted to demonstrate at the show. What was in your mind when you were sort of creating it in terms of the demonstrations that you've got here for people to see?
Yeah, you're right, Ben. It's very difficult to, in a relatively small space, to explain or demonstrate everything there is to see, and we need to cover both pea crops and bean crops, and indeed increasing interest in novel pulses as well. And we tried to do that, but also taking the view that the topics that people have been talking about the last few years is how to mitigate changeable weather, and we've done that particularly with the bean demonstration here. There's at the back of the stand you've got conventionally sown winter beans, sort of mid-October establishment, but growers over the last few years have been caught out with wet winters, to be honest, and not managed to get the beans in time, and some growers have taken the decision to plant early and have gone in mid-September. This is fraught with a bit of danger. Beans that get established too early can become too tall and prone to physical damage, either through wind battering them about or in the event of some heavy frost or snow, some physical damage in that way. And also they become early exposed to chocolate spot, which then presents season-long management issues to keep on top of it. And at the back of the stand here, we've got two blocks. You can see a little bit extra earliness in this September sown block, but you can also see a much heavier rust infection. By comparison, we're also showing what happens if you don't manage those plots for rust, and what happens if you adopt a two-spray program. And there's a really stark contrast between what appears to be increasing devastation on the unsprayed crop area, even between yesterday and today.
It's quite visually clear to see. And you've also We've been talking about some of these challenges that growers come across, or indeed some of the choices that they've got remaining in the event of a bad year in terms of sowing winter beans in the spring. What are your sort of findings and general advice for growers who perhaps are backed into a corner by difficult weather conditions and such like, in terms of getting the crop that they want to get in the ground when battling the weather?
Yeah, so the two scenarios really, aren't there? There's the I hoped to get my winter beans in but missed the window and the weather turned against me, and I've got the seed, what do I do with it? So that's a question. One option then is to take the seed and sow it as a spring sown bean, of course, which you can do if you get them in early enough in the spring. You just need to make sure that you're getting the seed rate up more to a spring bean level, so obviously you've got a bit of extra cost there. By and large though, it works reasonably well. It's unlikely to be quite as good as a winter sown winter bean, but it won't be a disaster, and probably an awful lot better than having no beans at all. Equally, growers who can't get hold of winter bean seed, perhaps, because sometimes that is a problem, ask us, well, can we sow spring bean seed in the winter? And the answer is yes, you can. We've been doing that for about 8 or 10 years now. We've got quite a good data set that shows really good performance. There's a block here that's been sown in that way, and you can see that it is at the same stage of maturity, maybe even a little bit earlier than the winter bean blocks that are here. You just need to, with those, you need to be aware that you need to still sow it at the spring bean seed rate, because they won't branch like the winter beans do.
Which is, what sort of rate would you advise?
About 50 to 60 plants per square metre. You're aiming for that as established plants number.
So I guess there's a big theme of volatility and managing risk to what we're seeing on the stand here today. What kind of questions have been coming at you from people who have been visiting. We've touched on with Erin earlier about people who have been away from the crop for a few years, now looking to go back into it due to sort of changes in environmental policy, etc. Have you fielded some of those questions? And have there only been other sort of topics that have been recurring?
It's really hard, Ben. The range of questions is huge. From, you know, I've never seen winter peas before, didn't know you could grow them, are they frost hardy, right through some really basic agronomy questions about peas and beans for growers, like you say, coming back into, or indeed still never grown pulses, which, you know, in our little world we find hard to believe, but there's still a huge number of people out there who are essentially novice growers, and we're here to help them. The intercropping demonstration always attracts a lot of interest. It's still a very novel concept for many people, and I suppose the predominant question is, how the hell do you harvest those? But, you know, there's answers and there's experience, and we're here to help people.
And for people who are perhaps finding this episode for the first time, and, you know, indeed aren't aware of PGRO, it's an obvious plug, but what is the best way, or best ways, to access the information and advice that's available through the organisation?
Well, hopefully we're accessible, Ben. There is a very comprehensive website there. I know everybody's not technology savvy, or even just very reluctant to engage with yet more apps, etc. We do have an app for Crop Monitor. Pick up the phone, just give us a call.
And the Pulse Open Day, of course, which is fast approaching, just down the road from the cereals site here. So we'll be welcoming growers and agronomists to that to look, I guess, at some of the similar sort of trials that you've got here. Roger, is that fair to say? A bit of a preview of what might be on show next month?
Yeah, I mean, you come to these events, don't you? We all make a great effort to put out nice plots, and let's face it, they are a bit manicured just to make sure they look good for the event. Not too much, I hope, on this stand. But what you'll see at our open day is our real trials. There's 15 hectares of actual trials, and you just get to see what we do.
Yeah, warts and all, I guess, because we've had a...
Big warts.
It's a difficult year. I mean, one of the standout things from coming to this site this year compared to last year is probably the height of some of these trials that you've got, or plot demonstrations that you've got here. Generally speaking, the crop seems to be in good health. What's your sort of take on where we are in terms of crop welfare, if you like, so far from the ones that you were looking at?
The crops here on the stand look really healthy. They are short. They had virtually no rain on them from establishment through to right to the end of May. They've been saved by the last two or three weeks of changeable weather, but looking pretty good considering. Crops in general, if that's what you're asking, I think individuals will have their own experience, but very wide ranging, some excellent crops to some really poor ones, and I think that just is the geographical weather effect.
Yeah, certainly some extra challenges out there for growers to contend with. So if you are interested in hearing more about what PGRO's trialling this year, then of course the open day is coming up next month. With Dr. Chris Judge now, who has been very busy talking to people for the past couple of days, and there's an awful lot of interest in intercropping, particularly at the stand. There's a lot of people wandering on and just wondering exactly why would you do it? How do you do it? How do you harvest it? I guess is probably the questions you've been getting, Chris, is it? Has there been anything else that's cropped up?
A few of the questions, but they're the main ones, and I'm sorry that you've had to wait for a while to get a moment when I'm not being robbed.
You're a busy man. But
yeah, no, it's obviously quite visually striking coming up and seeing the intercrops. You know, people who don't grow them very much are often like, why would you be doing this in the first place? And I think there's really sort of three main reasons that always come up. One is often quite attractive to organic growers because they really suit a low input system. Secondly, it's also got a use for things like whole cropping and forage and silage. And thirdly, they're often done by people who've got a mixed farm, where the reason that they're doing their intercropping is for doing protein that they're going to feed into their own livestock. But again, they're doing it in a low input way to be sort of saving costs compared to buying in soil.
So we've got a variety of demonstrations here. We've got peas and oats, we've got peas and beans, we've got spring beans and spring oats. Just, you know, taking your expertise, Chris, what do you think is perhaps the most interesting one, or you know, that you've been doing over the past few years? What kind of one has perhaps got the most headlines out of, do you think?
I think most people, the uptake is probably largest for beans and oats. You hear people actually sort of referring to it as boats. It's got its right. own bit of cultural cachet now, sort of thing. But
any particular reason for that one being most popular?
I think it is not just due to the catchiness of the name, but I think people find it quite an attractive looking crop, sort of thing, and it has separating a bean from oat is quite easy if you would like to separate them, and the beans have got quite an obvious end use in a sort of a livestock system. But I think the more interesting one is the double pulse, with you've got the peas and beans together, and that's not just coming because PGRO is interested in both crop elements rather than one. But you have a lot more, again, a lot of these are done as low input systems, particularly when you're mixing a cereal with a pulse, and even the oats rather than the wheat, there's still a real reduction in chemistry options, which is fine because you're often growing them quite thick, so you don't need too much herbicide anyway. They're having the two different crop types in there makes them harder for disease to spread because it's often only susceptible on one and not the other. So they do suit a low input system, but by doing the double pulse means that you can put inputs in more easily if needed. So if it is, say, a bad year for bean rust, the sort of products that you might put on spring beans for bean rust, several of them are also available on peas. Again, the same thing, if you have a herbicide problem, there's a commonality in some of the options, not all of the options. And again, same as aphicides. So you do have more options for control if you need it. But also, a lot of these are being done for bulk and for protein. And with the pea and bean, both components are doing the protein. And again, then with the mixed ones, you're gaining the benefit of the nitrogen fixed by the pulse, meaning that you're growing, say, the oats without any fertilizer, which is a good saving in oat fertilizer costs. But it also means that then the oats are using some of the fixed nitrogen within the season rather than using it for the following one, whereas your pea bean is doing more of the role that the pulse usually does on the crop of fully enriching it for the future. So for those reasons, I lean towards that option, but it also does tend to lead to quite a robust bulk crop, which again, for the whole crop people as well, that's also the one that they're most interested in. I was talking to one of the guys who works on that earlier, saying that he's increasing, just having quite a large number of his farmers having that as one of the things that they're running through as an option.
Right, interesting. So yeah, different decisions based on what you're actually intending to use it for at the end. We touched on seed rates earlier, which I think is quite interesting in terms of what density you're actually planting these at. What's your kind of lesson that you've learned about that?
This is one of the main things we've been doing in trial with these, is trying to answer that question. Because if somebody thinks, oh, I want to try it, it's the first question that comes up. What sort of seed rate should I be looking at? What's going to outcompete each other? What's going to do what? So we've done lots of trials where you think, oh, well, we'll do 50-50, we'll do all sorts of things like that. What we found that the benefit comes best at sort of economic optimum for leaving the pulse at its normal rate. So this might seem slightly counterintuitive, that surely you've got to reduce it down to make room for the oats, for example. But no, if you're leaving peas at their full rate, there is still room in a pea crop for a slender oat stem to come through it and for things still to be all right. So we'll do the peas at sort of 70 plants a square metre still, we'll do the beans at 50 plants a square metre still, and then just add the oat or the wheat or the barley on top of it at a lower rate. So for your oats, say, you would be wanting to do that sort of a third to a quarter of normal, because otherwise that's going to be start smothering the peas. You can't put both things at a full rate, but no matter what, you end up with a density between the two of them that is much greater than you would do a standard, which, as I said, is really good for weed suppression if you're doing this for organic reasons.
Yeah, and it's a lovely picture to sort of to see here, in that the sort of oats are providing a bit of scaffolding around the pulses as they grow on. So it's quite a striking crop plot to look at. For people who are doing this, how are they getting on with harvest or post-harvest separation?
Yeah, like, as you said about the scaffold, that is one of the main reasons also to be doing this in the first place, is using it as a scaffold for the peas. So many people come up for an event like Ceres and say, do you have a new pea with a perfectly rigid stem that will never fall over no matter what the weather is? And the answer is always no. We score standing ability in different pea varieties. There is important variation, but that variation sort of, you know, applies in a medium lodging year. If it's sort of weather that will drag everything to the ground, it drags everything to the ground. If it's perfectly dry with no wind, it'll all be upright. And those differences is in that sort of interim level. But the answer is, do you have something that will lead peas to stay upright? The answer is, put them with something else that's got a stronger stem that they can grip to. And even if they still fall sideways, that extra bulk with them really helps them be picked up by your combine header. Harvesting otherwise, as you asked about, it is a bit of a delicate balancing act in how you set up your combine. You know, you have to be bearing in mind, certainly say we're talking pea oats, that the pea is the limiting factor on your concave size, that you don't want to have that too tight and be crushing them. But you also need to then be looking at the wind speed of the combine for losing the oats out the back. You're always going to lose some oats out of the back if the combine is set up effectively for peas. But when I've been talking about the benefits of it and that we tend to come out ahead economically, that's always done on trials that have been combined together and have lost certain amounts of the oats out the back. You know, had somebody coming up the other day, yesterday at Cereal, saying, I think you'd lose all the oats out the back. You don't. We end up with oats still in the bag at the end. You lose 5 or 10% of the lighter oats out the back. If you've dropped the wind speed, your sample is obviously a bit dirtier. You'll need to go through the seed cleaner. But then you can really set that up at the level where you're happy with the wind speed that you're gaining as much as you can from it. But yeah, no, you're going to lose some oats in a PO to a bean oat mix. However, our calculations to do with it are always done on trials where that's already happened.
It's obviously attracting a lot of attention here today, as it has done for the past few years that you've had these demonstrations at Cereals and at other events, your Open Day, etc. What's your sense for how many growers are actually doing it and being inspired to try it? It feels like there's a lot more people having a go at it now. We obviously don't know exact numbers, but have you got a sense of that? Are there lots more people trying it, or is it still quite small numbers, would you say?
It's definitely changed a lot. You know, we initially have been working on this for quite a few years now, and we've had plots about it at Cereals for quite a few years now. But it's very much, we've moved along with the industry and the country together. You know, we didn't do it in the first place for no reason. We did it because it was being sort of discussed in the grapevine as an interesting possibility. But I would say, you know, say 5 years ago at Cereals, people were coming up and going, what on earth is this? What's going on here? People, and then say maybe 2-3 years ago, it was like this is that intercropping thing. How do you get on with it? And now we're hearing a lot more of yes, this is an intercrop mix. I know somebody who does this. Obviously not everyone is saying that, but it moves from a mystery to something that's known about but not seen to something that's seen. Again, that's very anecdotal, but you know, I've had people coming up saying, you know, I've done one of these combinations but not the other one. Say, I've done some bean and oats, but I've never seen the pea and bean together. Or, you know, I've been talking to some people who are involved in whole cropping and things, and they say, yeah, you know, this is a significant percentage of what we're doing now. You know, I've got, you know, a load of somebody was saying earlier, you know, I was just up in County Durham yesterday and I saw a big field of this. I spoke to somebody from Farmers Weekly a few minutes ago and they said they'd seen some peas and oats yesterday. And so it is something that is increasing in prevalence, and it will probably hit a ceiling at some point. You know, it is not a go-to solution that this is how you should be growing all your crops now. It is for certain markets, certain styles of farm management, and certain sort of closed systems. You know, it has its negatives. You know, the combining is more difficult, the drilling logistics is more difficult, the seed costs are up because you're putting more things initially into the ground in the first place, but you would tend to lower your inputs and you would hopefully be making a particularly if you're using it yourself for livestock, hopefully you would be making a saving versus Brazilian soya, say.
Yeah. And just finally, it's very hard to describe exactly what we're looking at here and the variety that you've got on show and how those interactions between the two crops look. The open day is coming up. Do we have something to look at the open day for those growers and agronomists who want to come and see some of the trials you've been doing this year?
Yeah. If you didn't walk past these plots at cereals, you can come to our open day where we've also got intercrops happening. So we've got some spring intercrop trials like we have here there. They have suffered a bit in this summer's drought, so they will be at shorter heights than they would usually be at, but they will still be there and can be discussed and looked over. But we've also got a decent sized winter intercrop trial set up there this year, doing not only combinations of winter wheat and winter beans, but also looking at winter peas and winter triticale and some forage peas in the mixes as well. So really sort of taking it to some slightly different end uses and looking at what can create a big bulk over the winter, and again looking at those for their forage potential as well as their direct feed potential. So the winter ones in particular looked really good. The spring ones were a bit shorter than we'd like, but come and have a chat about them anyway.
Well, there you go. So if you've interested in what Chris has been talking about, come and find out in more detail at the open day. Well, that's about it from our special cereals episode. Very hard to be able to describe everything that's been going on the PGRO stand, but hopefully this has given you a bit of a flavour for some of the themes that have been tackled over the past couple of days. We're all off to have a good pint of water and to get some shade away from the sun. If you would like to know more about anything that you've heard on today's episode, as has been trailed throughout the show, there is the PGRO Open Day on the 8th of July, and that really is an excellent opportunity to not only see some of the things that you've been hearing about today, but also talk to many more of the PGRO staff who haven't featured in the episode about some of the work that they're doing on variety trial evaluations, product development, novel crops. There's lots more going on than we've talked about today. So if you can make it to Stubton in Lincolnshire on the 8th of July, it's free. Kicks off at 10 o'clock in the morning, and you can just drop in for as long as you want to find out what's been going on with PGRO. But in the meantime, please visit pgro.org or contact us via our social channels or on good old-fashioned phone if that's what you'd like to do. PGRO is always very keen to engage with growers and to hear what you're doing and also offer advice on areas that you would like some support on. But otherwise, that's it for today. We will be putting out our next episode very shortly. It's going to be covering innovation in crop protection. We've got another special guest joining us for that one. So if you hit the subscribe button, you'll be alerted every time we produce a new episode. And if you can, please leave us a nice review on whichever podcast provider that you use. It really does help us reach more growers. And that's what it's all about, getting that information across. And I hope that today's episode has done that. Hope you enjoyed it. Bye for now.